It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Iowa caucuses are only a week away. Later this hour, we'll find out about a new play being written about the caucuses. It's called Three Tickets Out. But first, candidates and their surrogates are frantically stumping for votes. Many caucus goers are still trying to make up their minds. And pollsters all over the country are trying to figure out what's going to happen when Iowans get together next Monday evening. We're going to talk this hour about the science and art of political polling. My guest is Peter Hansen. He is director of the Grinnell College National Poll and an associate professor of political science at Grinnell. Peter, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And before we get down to the nuts and bolts of how a poll is conducted and what we can and cannot learn from them, I want to talk about the caucuses, because the caucuses are famously difficult to call. What's unique about this situation that drives pollsters crazy?
Well, there's a couple of factors. The first is that public opinion right now is a moving target. And by that, I mean that, Iowans start to pay attention to the race at different points. So there's a lot of people who may not have made up their minds. And their opinions for a time may not be firm. They may favor one candidate and then change their minds to favor another. So those two factors alone, the fact that people are making up their minds and then may change their minds, makes it hard to predict. And then, of course, the final factor is when you're a pollster, you have to identify people who are actually going to caucus. And that can be quite difficult to make sure you are talking with the people who are actually going to be caucusing on February 3rd.
Well, and there's also that opportunity to have your mind changed once you go to the caucus. That has to make it really difficult to know what's going to happen as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the challenges we have right now is we've got a large field, and we have a number of candidates who are polling very close to the margin of eligibility. So you need to get at least 15% support in a caucus in order to win delegates, and we've got candidates who are just at that or just above that. And so that makes predicting the actual outcome very difficult, because in any given caucus, you might have Joe Biden coming in at 14% or Joe Biden coming in at 16%. And so depending on the particular caucus we're talking about, those candidates may or may not win delegates. And that makes the outcome very hard to predict.
All right. Well, we will talk more about the caucuses a little bit later in the hour. But let's just talk about polls in general. And I want to go back in time to when political polls in the United States really started happening. That was back in the 40s and 50s, right?
That's right. That is when the science of statistics and technology came together to make it possible to reach out to large numbers of people relatively cost effectively and try and assess where the public stood on matters.
So the statistics allowed the science to get underway, but it has, of course, advanced a great deal since then. How accurate were those early polls when we first started taking them?
Well, the early polls had a lot of trouble, and that's because pollsters were really trying to get the best sense of how to conduct polling. And there's sort of a famous example here that political scientists like to point to, and it's a poll that was conducted in the 1936 presidential election by the magazine Literary Digest. And they were famous for their polling, and their method was to send letters to millions of Americans and try and get a response from them about their preference for the presidential election. And what happened was they incorrectly predicted the outcome of the 1936 race. They thought that Alf Landon was going to win over Democrat Franklin Roosevelt. And it turns out the reason for that error was they had been drawing their list of Americans to poll from a variety of sources, but one of which was telephone listings. Well, of course, in the 1930s, only wealthy people had telephones. And so if you only polled wealthier Americans, you were likely to get a sample that disproportionately favored Landon over Roosevelt. And so because that poll had a bad sample of Americans, they incorrectly predicted the outcome. Now, we've gotten better since then. We've learned a lot more about how to accurately sample American opinion. But that's been part of how the science has developed. We've had to refine our techniques for identifying a sample of people that reflects public opinion more broadly.
As the country changed over time, that made people easier to access because everybody had a telephone after a certain time. Was there kind of a golden age of polling?
Well, you know, once we get into the 1950s and 60s and phones become very widespread, it becomes easy to reach large numbers of people. You know, and so for that time forward, really through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was pretty easy to get a reliable sample of American opinion. Now, it's actually become more challenging in recent years as different methods of communication have flourished. I mean, we all have cell phones now, but we rarely answer those phones. Over time, that's made it harder and harder to reach Americans, to talk to them about their political views. And we can still do it. We can still get relatively accurate samples, but it's getting harder.
Well, and let's talk about how we do that in this modern environment, because as you said, I mean, we all have cell phones. Most of us have cell phones. A lot of us don't answer any number that we don't recognize. A lot of people still have landlines, but that group of people tends to be older, and a lot of us don't answer those phones either. So when you're designing a poll these days in this modern environment, where do you start?
Well, you know, it turns out that the standard methods still work the best. And by the standard method, I mean that when we conduct a poll, we get on the phone and we just start making phone calls and talk to those who pick up their phone. And if you make enough of those calls, you do reach enough people to get an effectively random sample of Americans. And that's what we're looking for. We need those folks we reach to basically represent a random selection of Americans. Now, that doesn't happen perfectly. I mean, some of the factors that you mentioned do have an impact. For example, folks who have landlines tend to be disproportionately older than the rest of the country. In fact, people who are likely to answer their phones are likely to be disproportionately older than the rest of the country. And so we have to take that into account. We know that our sample on average will consist of older voters that are older than the average age. And so when we are presenting results, then we have to do what's called weighting them. That is, we make slight adjustments so that our survey population matches the census, the characteristics of the population as measured by the U.S. Census.
How do you weight them?
It's a technical process, but basically you look at a few key factors. Typically that can be things like age and education, and you adjust the weight given to each respondent in the sample based on their characteristics, so that if you know that you have too few young people in your sample, you just add a little bit more weight onto the opinions of young people, so that when you're reporting your survey results as a whole, you compensate for the fact that there are fewer of them in your sample. If you don't do that, you end up with a distorted opinion. If we, for example, only reported the opinions of older Americans, we wouldn't be accurately representing the views of the population.
Even though we do know that older Americans are more likely to vote, so there's a little bit of that involved in it as well.
Oh, sure. Well, that's a separate question, actually, is asking people who is likely to vote. So that is something else we ask as well. And when we have that information, we can work with it as well. So that's part of the art and part of the science. You know, the science is to get a sample that is as accurate as possible. And there's a science in statistically knowing the proper way to weight that sample up to the true population characteristics. And through all of this, we do the very best that we can to accurately represent public opinion.
Let's talk about sample size, because when we look at polls, you know, we see that, 40% of the American people think this. Now, of course, not all of the American people have been polled. When we look at a poll, is there a way to see the sample size?
Well, a good news article when it's reporting on a poll, should report the sample size, or, you know, readers can always look up the poll themselves. Good polls are always publicly available in that you can look up their methodology. But really, savvy readers should be looking for polls conducted by neutral organizations with sample sizes ideally around 1,000 people. If you see anything below 500, I would not regard a sample size of that size as reliable. But once you're up to about 1,000 people, you can have within a few points of a few degrees margin of error, a pretty accurate analysis of American opinion.
Well, and let's talk about margin of error, because that's a statistical phrase, and it's extremely important in understanding these polls. What does it mean?
Well, every poll is a fuzzy snapshot of the electorate. When we sample the American population, you know, we are in our poll, the Grinnell College National Poll, we are calling 1,000 people and asking them for their views. Statistically, we know that when you sample 1,000 people, the views that are expressed will reflect the population as a whole within a margin of uncertainty, typically, you know, plus or minus, say, 3 percentage points. So whenever we report a result, you know, and that result might be, well, 40% of Americans approve of the job that Donald Trump is doing as president, statistically what we mean is that we estimate, our best estimate is that 40% of Americans approve of the job the president is doing. But that the real number could fall within a range. It could fall within plus or minus, say, 3 percentage points of that number. So the true value within the population might be as low as 37% or as high as 43%. And we're confident that it is within that range. And our best estimate is the one that we gave you.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Peter Hansen, director of the Grinnell College National Poll and an associate professor of political science at Grinnell. We're talking about the science and art of polling right now. And you're welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll talk about a new play being written about the Iowa caucuses. It's called Three Tickets Out. But right now, we're talking about polls. And of course, a lot of us have been reading a lot of polls lately, trying to figure out what's going to happen next Monday night when Iowans get together to vote. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. If you have questions about polls, what you should be looking for when you read polls, how good polls are at predicting the future, you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. And with me now is Peter Hansen. He's director of the Grinnell College National Poll and an associate professor of political science at Grinnell. And Peter, just before the break, we were talking about the margin of error in polls. We talked about sample size. You mentioned looking for a neutral organization. You want to get your polls from an organization that is not going to try to skew the information to try to persuade people to think or act in a specific way. And there are a lot of polls out there that do come from organizations that are trying to do just that, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and sometimes organizations might try to do this purposely, and other times they may do it unintentionally. But it is very easy to shape opinion in a poll in the way you ask a question or in the order you ask a question. You know, my favorite example of this is you can imagine a poll that might ask respondents a series of questions. And the first might be, say we're talking about education. You might say, do you think that school children should have small class sizes? And a lot of folks would probably say, sure, yes. You know, should kids be taught music and art in school? A lot of folks might say, well, yes, absolutely. And then if you follow that with the final question, you know, do you think that taxes should be raised to support public education? Your first two questions have just made it more likely that people will answer yes to that final question. And so when you are designing a poll, you have to be very, very conscious of how you are writing your questions and how you are ordering your questions so you don't accidentally shape the answer that people are giving you. Now, there might be folks out there who are trying to write polls in a way that you know, deliberately leads to certain outcomes. So imagine we're talking about the impeachment trial. You could write a question that says, you know, basically, do you approve of the impeachment of the president by the House of Representatives? That would give you one answer. But you could also ask the question this way. Do you approve of the impeachment of President Trump by partisan Democrats in the House of Representatives? That would lead to a different answer. That would be more likely to activate people who have suspicions of that word partisan and probably a lower approval of impeachment. So when you are writing a poll, you have to be very, very careful to write questions in a neutral way. And of course, there are political organizations out there who might be deliberately trying to write questions in a more inflammatory way because it'll help to lead to a result that supports an outcome that they prefer.
Well, and we have a question from Dan that addresses exactly this, but from the perspective of somebody being asked to participate in a poll. He says, I'd be happy to respond to polls via my phones, but I've been burned too often by polls that claim to be nonpartisan, but slowly begin to ask questions that are very misleading and obviously partisans. How can we screen these calls instead of wasting our time and getting sucked into participating in an unqualified poll?
Well, it's a very, very hard question. I have a lot of sympathy for Dan. You know, when polls are conducted, it's just the case that, you know, pollsters don't automatically identify themselves in a way that clearly indicates to people who are answering where those questions are coming from. And you know, if you choose to respond to poll, which I always encourage folks to do, the best thing to do is to do what he says he's doing, and that is to listen carefully to those questions. And if they do seem to be getting to a point where they are trying to generate a response rather than just find an answer, that, you know, they should listen to themselves and decide whether they want to continue.
You were talking about really the scientific approach to writing these questions and ordering these questions in a way that doesn't skew the answers. But also, is there a way to make sure that the questions are delivered in a way that does not skew the answers? I assume that if you are making thousands of phone calls, that often you're employing a lot of people who don't necessarily have the background of a political scientist.
Well, typically these calls are made by calling centers that specialize in public polling. The most important thing is just to make sure you have a pretty large pool of people making calls. That way, from a statistical standpoint, the effect of any individual caller on the poll overall gets washed out. So, you know, whatever effect that caller may have. We actually know that people respond differently to calls based upon the perceived gender of the caller, sometimes based on their perceived belief in the race of the caller. There's a lot of things that shape the way that people respond to polling questions. And if you want to get an accurate read on the opinion of the country, one of the things you can do is just have a really large pool of people making calls so that any one effect gets washed out in the results.
I was looking at the results of some of the recent Grinnell College national polls, and here's a headline from one of your October 2019 results. People are proud to be Americans, but tired of political circus. So can you give me an idea when you're looking for not whether or not somebody's going to vote for something or who's going to win in an election, but when you're looking for more generalized information, how do you approach that as a pollster?
Well, we have a lot of conversations about it. Our pollster is Ann Seltzer, and as we're designing a poll, Ann and I and others here at Grinnell, we'll sit down and talk about what we want to find out. Sometimes what we want to find out is how people are feeling, you know, what their state of mind is. And when we do that, sometimes we look for, you know, phrases or identifying characteristics that might resonate with people. And so, you know, one of the questions we asked in our last poll was, you know, are you tired of the circus in politics? And we talked about that for a long time, you know, and the reason we talked about it was because it's an unusual question. But we thought, you know, this might resonate with people. This is very intense time in our politics. There's something new in the news every day. We're going through, at that point, we were headed toward an impeachment trial. And we just thought, it seems like people might just be exhausted by everything that's going on. So that's one style of question, you know, to come up with those kinds of phrases that might capture a state of mind. And we always take those answers with a little bit more of a grain of salt. I mean, that is definitely more art than science in terms of what we're trying to find out there. Other questions, we are very careful to zero in on a particular topic we're interested in. So, for example, when we asked about impeachment, we took a three-step approach in which we first asked our respondents about the underlying conduct. You know, do you think an elected official should be asking a foreign government to intervene in an election on their behalf? And then we asked about people's views about a House impeachment effort, and then about whether or not the president should be removed from office. So we tried to really systematically break down each element of impeachment so we understood how all those pieces fit together as well as possible. So any given part of that poll, we're thinking about very hard and what we're trying to accomplish.
We're talking about political polling this hour, and you're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Peter Hansen is with me, director of the Grinnell College National Poll and an associate professor of political science at Grinnell. And Peter, we were talking about how technology has changed polling and made it more difficult to get people on the phone. I see when I interact with people through social media, polls online show up quite a bit where, you know, somebody wants you to click on and take a poll. Is there a way to do an online poll that could be as accurate as a telephone poll?
Well, it's very difficult. And the reason is that if, you know, if you see a poll pop up on your Facebook feed and you decide to take it, you know, you are choosing to opt into that. So there is a self-selection going on with those kind of polls. And, you know, the kind of people who choose to participate in a poll may be different than the kind of people who choose not to. And what that means is your sample of respondents is not random. And the only time we can say with confidence that results are accurate is when we know we have a random sample of the population. So there have been some polling organizations that have experimented with online polling. I don't think it's an area that's been mastered yet. And so, you know, the only results I'm most confident in are those which are done the old-fashioned way, in which you have live interviews being done over the phone in a real conversation between two people.
We watch the polls closely leading up to an election, and then on election day, we watch the exit polls very closely. Mm-hmm. What is different about exit polls?
Well, with exit polls, you have pollsters basically positioned outside different polling places, talking to people as they leave their polling place. There have been some problems with reliability on exit polls because, again, they're not perfectly scientific. You are intercepting people as they come out. Your sample hopefully is good, but it's not a totally random sample. They are a reasonably good reflection of opinion, but not always perfect.
All right. But tend to be more reliable than those polls that are trying to predict the future, would you say?
Well, you know, I think it depends. It depends on how well that exit poll is conducted and whether or not you are getting, again, a good sample of the population. Everything depends on the sample that you're getting. If your sample of people that you're talking to is not a random sample of voters in this case, then you're going to have problems with reliability. And a lot of the, I guess I would say, when people see concerns about the accuracy of polling, it tends to come from a couple of different places. You know, sometimes we may be having problems getting an accurate sample of voters. That's the issue with exit polls. And sometimes what we're seeing are really closely divided elections where the outcome is actually within the margin of error. And in those kind of cases, it's difficult for pollsters to say with confidence, you know, who's ahead in a race. And so I think in those kind of situations, you know, what's going on is there's just genuine statistical doubt about an outcome. But when those things happen, I think it causes people to lose some confidence in the reporting that they're seeing.
We have just a few minutes left, and I want to bring it back around to the Iowa caucuses again.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, a famously difficult thing to conduct polls about because of how the caucuses work and all of the different things that are in flux leading up to caucus night. You mentioned Ann Seltzer, who is your pollster with the Grinnell National Poll. And she called in 2008, she called the caucuses for Obama. And she was one of the very few people who saw that coming. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable moment. So what else beyond writing good questions and making enough phone calls, what does a pollster bring to this process that can make it possible for somebody like Ann Seltzer to make a call like that?
Well, that's a great question for Ann. You know, I don't. I think you know, in my conversations with her, what I know she focuses on a lot is trying to identify people who are actually going to show up on caucus night, and that's really the trick. Sometimes polling organizations might just look at lists of registered Democrats. But of course, in Iowa, where you can register right at the beginning of the caucus, you know, that's not necessarily a good indication of who your pool is going to be. And so the trick is to ask people, ask as broad a swath of people as possible, even people who might not have caucused before, even people who might not have considered themselves Democrats previously, ask them if they're going to be caucusing. And then base your findings on your best judgment of who's actually going to show up. That is one of the things that's difficult, again, finding the people who are actually going to show up on caucus night. And, you know, then the other things, again, are what I talked about before. People are making up their mind very late. There's a lot of candidates out there. And of course, in any given caucus, if one of those candidates doesn't meet the threshold of eligibility, people have to go with their second choice. So those are all the elements of uncertainty, but getting an accurate result starts with talking to the right group of people who will actually be caucusing on February 3rd.
A lot of us will be watching these polls very, very carefully this week. As we're looking at polls, do you have advice for how to get the best information?
Well, the first thing I would suggest to people is to take any individual poll result with a grain of salt. And that's because a lot of the times when you see headlines in the newspaper, you know, one candidate is now up by 2 points, another candidate is down by 2 points, you know, most of the time that's movement in the margin of error. You know, again, if I conducted the same poll 20 times in a row, from a statistical standpoint, I would get, 19 out of 20 times, I would get an answer within a range, you know, basically say a 6-point range. And so what I'm confident in is that the true result is somewhere in that range. That's why I say a poll is a fuzzy snapshot of the electorate. So when you see movement within that range, that could be real or it could just be statistical noise. So one thing people should do is just take every poll with a grain of salt. The best thing for them to do is to go onto a polling aggregator website. And that's a website like 538 where people like Nate Silver take all the polls and then they analyze them and they come up with an average of what all the polls say. You'll get a more reliable answer by looking at all the polls together than you will by any one poll individually.
We are out of time. Peter, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Peter Hansen, director of the Grinnell College National Poll and an associate professor of political science at Grinnell. And of course, we'll know the results of the Iowa caucuses by Tuesday morning next week. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about a new play being written about the Iowa caucuses. It's called Three Tickets Out, and it's being written by a group of actors and playwrights who live in New York City. But Jordan Whalen is from Iowa, and he first went to the caucuses 12 years ago. He's been wanting to write a play about them ever since. I'll talk with him in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.